May it please the court, Anthony Noble, registration number 33910 for the appellant Terence Smith. In this case, Mr. Smith entered a guilty plea to one count of criminal trespass and one count of third degree sexual assault. And he was given a deferred judgment for the trespass count and 2 years of probation for the sexual assault. And the conditions of probation were to complete sex offender therapy and to register as a sex offender. He successfully completed the deferred judgment and his probation in March 2003. And then in 2006, he filed a petition to deregister from the sex offender registry. There was an error in the court record that indicated that both convictions resulted in a deferred judgment, but that was resolved by the court by looking at the transcripts, and it was clarified that it was a deferred judgment on the trespass, and it was actually a probation sentence for the sex assault. So that petition to deregister was denied because it was prematurely filed. Mr. Smith then retained new counsel, and in 2010 he again filed a petition to deregister, and his counsel was under the misapprehension that he was given a deferred judgment for both counts, and again that petition was denied because it was prematurely filed. The court issued a written order denying that petition, and in the written order the court clarified that probation was given for the sexual assault count and that probation was successfully completed in 2003 and that the petition would be timely after 10 years. So in May of 2013, Mr. Smith filed a third petition to deregister. This time it was filed more than 10 years after the probation had been completed, and the court just denied on the caption. The court's denial of that petition was an error because under subsection 1132C, the court was required to hold a hearing on the petition to deregister. Mr. Smith was clearly eligible to petition for deregistration because he had petitioned more than 10 years after the completion of the probation, and he had gone through all of the requirements of subsection 2, 1132, given notice to the sheriff's office and the district attorney's office. And the statute clearly states that the court shall set a hearing, which the court didn't do. The court just summarily denied the petition. So it seems clear that the court's denial of the petition was an error, and the denial should be reversed, and the court should be required to hold a hearing.
Mr. Noble, does a petition on its face have to show eligibility in order for the court to be required to hold a hearing?
Well, Your Honor, there's no specific requirement in the statute that says that the petition has to demonstrate eligibility. And in this case, I don't think that that's really an issue because the court was aware that this petitioner was eligible because it was the same judge who denied this petition that denied the previous petition, in which he acknowledged that probation was successfully completed in 2003, that this was a probationary sentence and not a deferred judgment, and that there was a 10-year period before he could petition. So it's exactly the same judge that was aware of Mr. Smith's eligibility, and therefore the error in that third petition is really immaterial. And then also in the petition itself, even though Mr. Smith's current attorney had misidentified the sentence as a deferred judgment rather than probation, he did clearly state in the very first paragraph that this petition was being filed under subsection 1131B, which is the subsection of the statute for a class one misdemeanor third degree sexual assault. So the relevant part of the statute was clearly stated in the petition. The judge was aware that this wasn't a deferred judgment, it was actually a probationary sentence. The judge was also aware that the probationary sentence had been completed in March 2003 and that there was a 10-year period for filing for deregistration under the relevant part of the statute, and that this petition was filed after that 10-year period. So I don't think that error, referring to the sentence as a deferred judgment rather than probation, is really material.
Although if the trial court were to have a hearing, it certainly has the discretion to deny eligibility.
Yes, Your Honor, that's clear. But what is clear as well is that the trial court doesn't have any discretion whether or not to grant a hearing. The statute uses mandatory language, shall set the matter for a hearing. And a division of this court in People v. Carbajal explained that that language means that the court is required to set a hearing. The Carbajal decision was decided in 2012, and since then we've probably had about three or four legislative sessions, and the General Assembly hasn't amended the statute to clarify that when it said shall set the matter for a hearing, that it didn't mean that the court was required to hold a hearing.
Importance, if any, do you give the difference in the language in the statutory subsections, set the matter for a hearing or set a date for a hearing? Do you think that there's any discernible difference between those two?
I'm not sure that there is, Your Honor. I mean, it's clearly distinct language, and the procedures are different. Under subsection 1.3, it's the court that initiates the deregistration process, and prior to the completion of the deferred judgment, the court has to give notice to the victim, has to set the matter for a hearing, and then if there are any objections made or if there's a request for a hearing, then the court is required to hold a hearing. But under the statute, the part of the statute that we're proceeding under, subsection 2C, the deregistration process is initiated by the defendant. The defendant files the petition, and on receipt of the petition, then the court shall set the case for a hearing. So I don't think there's really any meaningful distinction. The mandatory language is used in both parts of the statute. It's a requirement for the court to hold a hearing, and at least one division of this court has recognized that that is a requirement. It's not an act of discretion. It's a requirement that's imposed upon the court. And that's what the court didn't do in this case. The court just summarily denied the petition. Now, the court didn't give any reasons for denying the petition, so we don't know whether the court did exercise any discretion, whether the court was mistaken that somehow it previously denied this for some other reason and it was denying it for the same reason, or whether the court had completely forgotten about its prior order in which it acknowledged that probation was completed in 2003 and that there was a 10-year period. All we know is that there was the denial that didn't comply with the statute. So the Attorney General makes two arguments for you to affirm the denial of the petition. The first argument, which we've already discussed, is that the allegations in the petition weren't sufficient because instead of saying that he'd completed his probation in 2003, he stated that he completed a deferred judgment in 2003. But that's really immaterial because even if the court was reliant on the petition alone and wasn't reviewing the record, then a hearing would still be required because there's no 10-year period to file a petition after a successful completion of a deferred judgment. So even if the court wasn't relying on its own file and on the record, looking at the face of the petition itself, a hearing is still required. But even if the court was looking at the file, then it would see that probation was completed in 2003, that more than 10 years has passed, it acknowledged that there was a 10-year time period, and therefore Mr. Smith was eligible. There should be no confusion about his eligibility. And again, he complied with all of the requirements for filing the petition, or the notice requirements, and therefore the court was required to give a hearing. Now, the other argument that the Attorney General makes is that the word shall set it, or the phrase shall set a date for a hearing, doesn't actually mean that the court shall set a date for a hearing. I think the Attorney General is asking you not to follow the Carbajal decision, and that this actually means something else rather than a hearing, that it means a review date. But the plain language of the statute is that the court shall set a date for a hearing. And the legislature has made no attempt to correct the court's prior decision in Carbajal. So it's clear here that Mr. Smith was eligible to petition to deregister, that he followed all the requirements of the statute or the notice requirements, and that the court was required to give a hearing. The court didn't give a hearing, and therefore its order should be reversed, and this case should be remanded for an evidentiary hearing. Unless the court has any further questions, I'd ask to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter. I don't dispute that the defendant was eligible to petition when he filed this latest petition, but I don't think the trial court erred in summarily denying this, because I do think the defendant has an obligation to establish his eligibility in the petition itself and meet all the notice requirements in the petition. And because he didn't do that, I don't think the court erred in summarily denying this. I don't read the statute to require, and this is the bigger issue, to require hearing every time one of these petitions is filed, because you could have situations where a person is clearly ineligible to petition. And it would make no sense for a trial court to be required to hold a hearing when someone is clearly ineligible to petition. And I think there is a difference in this language, this shall set a hearing date language. And I think of a situation where, for example, a defendant is clearly eligible to petition. He set forth those facts in this petition that establish his eligibility, and the trial court verifies, yes, this is so. And then the trial court gets information from all the parties involved, the prosecutor, the victim, et cetera. Everybody agrees this person should be allowed to discontinue. And the trial court, in its own discretion, also agrees this person should be allowed to discontinue. I don't see the purpose in having a hearing under that scenario or under the scenario where the person is clearly ineligible to petition.
Ms. Van Horn, let me ask you a question. So you've given a scenario where perhaps someone may not be eligible and they petition, and you're saying a court should not be required to have a hearing in that instance. Let me ask you more. In this case, you're not disputing that Mr. Smith is eligible. So if a person is eligible, they may petition. And
correct.
So you're not disputing he is eligible and he did petition.
Correct.
And so why in this case are you saying it's not fair to have denied the hearing?
I think he had an obligation to set forth the facts that established his eligibility, which he did not do.
Okay.
And so on its face, because it was based on a fact that the judge twice told him was an erroneous fact, under these circumstances, and the defendant could have turned around, because there's nothing in the statute that prevents this. He could have turned around and filed yet another petition to discontinue and set forth the appropriate, established his eligibility in his petition, but he didn't do it.
So are you saying that's the remedy in this case, is that he just has to simply file another petition correcting the deferred adjudication language?
Yes, Your Honor.
Even though the court was obviously aware from the previous order that it was indeed a probation, I'm just, I guess, asking if that's sort of promoting form over substance.
To me, I'm looking at the bigger picture, you know, as far as we're looking at this as we need a hearing every time, and I don't think that's accurate. But in this case, I do think, especially he was represented by counsel, he wasn't pro se, there are other requirements the statute requires, the statutory framework requires, including the notice requirements. So I think he should be required to do that.
Okay, yes. I guess turning away from this case and looking at the bigger picture, I was interested in your argument that the difference in statutory language had some sort of meaning. I did a modest amount of looking at other jurisdictions to see if I could find other statutes with similar set. What's the one here, set a date for a hearing instead of set the matter for a hearing? And yeah, unless I'm remembering incorrectly, it looked like Oklahoma and Ohio may have had similar language and statutes, but I didn't see that they
drew a distinction.
Right. They seemed to look at that language as just requiring a hearing. And so I guess my question is, are you aware of any authority other than just your thoughts and reasoning about the difference in language? Are you aware of any jurisdictions that have given those sorts of differences any difference in actual meaning?
No, Your Honor, but I was thinking about the circumstance, and it's the circumstance where everybody is in agreement, for example, this person should discontinue, that it's perfectly acceptable. And if the trial court set, for example, a date for a hearing off in the future, which would give everybody adequate time to file objections, etc., and then sees, oh, everybody's on board, I'm looking at this, I think in my discretion it is acceptable, why have that hearing? The trial court can just issue that order. That setting that hearing date gives everybody the opportunity to know, like, this is the time the judge intends to review this. Get all your stuff in before then. And why, to me, it would just be unduly burdensome to have the trial court have a hearing when that's all it's going to be. We're all in agreement. And to do that, given how busy trial courts are.
Is that a matter for the General Assembly, though, given the language that they've chosen to put in the statute?
I don't know. And of course, Carvajal doesn't address this issue head on, but it should, it says that in passing. It's not looking at the questions that are presented here, what needs to be part of a proper petition, and that kind of thing. So, and it doesn't analyze this language as opposed to the other language. It just cites to this provision as supporting the proposition that the trial court's required to have a hearing. So I do think that's a distinction there. I'd ask this court to affirm the trial court's order unless it has any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it seems like there's no dispute that Mr. Smith is eligible to petition. He has petitioned. He made an error in the petition. So the resolution is really to remand, requiring the court to hold a hearing, or whatever you do, allowing Mr. Smith just to file another petition with the correct language this time, which the court would be required to give a hearing on. But I think the problem is that there is some confusion about the language in the statute and the decision in Carvajal. I mean, I think that the language is pretty clear that a hearing is required, and I think that the Carvajal court has made that clear, that the court is required to hold a hearing. But, you know, that was dicta within that decision. And the Attorney General has come up with a different interpretation of what that means, whether that means hold a hearing or whether that just means hold some kind of internal review. So, at the very least, I think that this court should clarify, you know, whether or not a hearing is required in this case, where Mr. Smith is eligible, he's followed all the requirements of the statute for filing his petition, and the statute indicates that the court should require a hearing. So I'd ask the court to remand, reverse the order denying the petition, remand the case for an evidentiary hearing, and just clarify that the statute requires the court to hold a hearing. And then at that hearing, the court does have discretion. Unless the court.
Do you disagree with the reading of the statute that the court is at minimum required to set a date for a hearing? And then if everyone's in agreement not to have the hearing, they don't need to proceed with the hearing?
Yes, certainly. That happens all the time. For instance, with petitions to seal, there's often no objection or no debate, but the court still sets the hearing, and often it requires people to turn up to the hearing and just go through the formalities. But usually what happens is if there are no objections, then the court just grants the petition and then vacates the hearing. And that's something that could be done here as well with a petition to deregister. So it doesn't mean that the court actually has to hold a hearing, but because in this case, there's no dispute that Mr. Smith is eligible to petition. He did file his petition more than 10 years after he completed probation. He followed all of the requirements of the statute, so a hearing is required, unless the court just wants to grant his petition to deregister without a hearing, and there are no objections to that. So unless the court has any further questions, I'd ask you to remand and reverse. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Your arguments have been very helpful today. This case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.